After decades without a major change, one of the busiest public parks in the state is a step closer to getting a facelift. The Honolulu Department of Parks and Recreation recently released a revised draft plan to make extensive renovations to Ala Moana Regional Park. Public pushback to the initial parking plan triggered the changes. The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty tells us more.
Ala Moana Regional Park sits on 100 acres of oceanfront land in urban Honolulu. It receives thousands of visits a week, making it the busiest park on Oahu, hence its name, the People's Park. Ala Moana's sprawling green space, numerous surf spots, and a half mile of sandy beach make it a popular location with both residents and visitors. Many come to exercise or just for a break from city life. Waipahu resident Paul Ishikawa visits Ala Moana 3 to 4 times a week.
You know, on the weekends, especially like maybe a three-day weekend, this place is just so heavily used. There's a lot of utility that's going on. There's a lot of local families that come out here and use the park. And it's a beautiful park, I think. And increasing the parking, I think more parking is pretty much a good thing.
Anything else that you'd like to see improved about the park?
You know, the one thing that I was thinking about a couple of days ago was how they don't put enough benches here. And sometimes they put the benches where they're not under a tree. And I don't like sitting in the hot sun in 90 degrees.
You got one of the shady ones today.
I got one of the best seats in the house today, right under a good tree with a lot of shade. And so I love this spot right here. And, you know, I do like this park. I think it's a great park. And I have friends from the mainland, they come here and they just comment to me what a beautiful park it is.
Kasei came down from Makiki to let her kids run around the park and visit the beach. She supports the city's plan to make improvements.
We like it over here because it's a little bit safer. It's not like the waves, it's not too, you know, too crazy for the kids. So I feel like it's safer over here. I can just let them play or, you know, play in the sand or go swim. Like some parking spot though. Sometimes during the holiday, it's kind of hard to find a parking around here. But other than that, you know, I'll be grateful with whatever they do over here.
Parking was one of the main issues raised by the community. Standing here on a weekday afternoon, the crowd is relatively light. But on a weekend, it can be almost impossible to find parking. The city wants to create more parking spots by reorienting existing spaces along Ala Moana Park Drive and Magic Island. Community opposition drove the city to modify that plan, but an additional 230 spots will still be created without sacrificing any green space. Michelle Nakoda is the city's director of Parks and Recreation.
The majority of the Makai parking was kept. We also heard from the residents that they wanted additional parking, and we've got 234 potential additional parking at Ala Moana as well. We've got improvements and renovations to the McCoy Pavilion, to the ponds, the edges of the ponds, as well as the canal. We also have improvements throughout the entire park, like for instance, the sand beach replenishment.
Beach replenishment will bring in several thousand cubic yards of sand to widen Ala Moana's artificial beach. All those improvements come with a hefty price tag. The draft plan has an estimated cost of $144 million over 10 years. Not all of the park's patrons were happy about that. Bob Miller is a resident of Chinatown and visits Ala Moana 3 times a week.
During the week, I love the parking is right by the water. I paddle surf and I enjoy that. And it's just a mellow place to be.
Have you heard about the city's plan to renovate the park at all?
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts about it?
I sure do. The other day I was biking through the park and I was with my wife and I noticed people homeless camping out in the park, and I said that, or I just thought that it would be much nicer for them to spend money on figuring out a way to get the homeless out of the park, and I think it's beautiful enough as it is.
Susan Oppie also had concerns about how the project's budget is being spent. She's the treasurer of the Ala Moana Kaka'ako Neighborhood Board.
I've been very vocal about the issue with litter in the park, and litter kind of kept flying through our neighborhood into the park and then into the ocean. And my thing has been that there's never, I've not seen mentioned anywhere that there's going to be any upgraded litter management or litter elimination kind of plan in this new EIS and kind of the, what they're kind of focusing on. Because as it stands now, at one point I walked through the park and counted over 120 of those just open mouth, you know, Rubbermaid trash cans that often have the bags blowing out of them or full of water or are chipped over. And, you know, that first of all, it's not very pleasant on the eye if they're really looking to make the park prettier. And secondly, it's just a really poor idea as far as how to manage trash on a beach. So I just feel like that, you know, and I also feel like there should be some education. I've got, you know, visions of what I would like for them to do as far as like just to bring public awareness to the issue of trash and why it's important for people to be responsible for their trash, especially when they're enjoying a day on the beach. But other than the litter, I find it a wonderful place to go. I can only imagine that this is all being kind of driven by the new developments that are happening, the new high rises, and how they just want it all to make it, you know, everything look prettier. So, you know, I'm not a big supporter of putting multi-millions of dollars into public projects if it's not, you know, to really improve environment and things like that. If it's just as a kind of cosmetic thing, then I'm sad that they're putting so much money into it. But I think it could really be a very positive thing for the environment as well.
The Parks Department is taking public comment on the proposal until late August. Testimony can be submitted online at honolulu.gov/parks. If all goes according to plan, the environmental assessment will be complete this winter, with planned improvements completed on a rolling basis over the next 10 years. From Ala Moana Regional Park, I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And we'll have a link with instructions for submitting testimony posted on today's edition of The Conversation podcast. You can look for it after 1 p.m. at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the search for historical treasures on the ocean floor. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're going bird watching back in time to find a species that once thrived in the Hawaiian Islands. It didn't have much of a chance after human settlement began because these birds were big and flightless, a fatal combination when humans were able to easily target them as a food source. The bird had a jaw like a turtle, and that's the source of its scientific name, which combines the Greek word for turtle with the Latin word for broken, and that refers to the shattered state of the original fossil that allowed scientists to identify the creature. For 3 million years, they thrived in the islands without major predators, roamed through the forest, and foraged, much like mammals, getting around on strong, sturdy legs. Their discovery and subsequent identification came relatively late from subfossil material collected on Kauai in 1976. This bird is commonly referred to as the large Kauai goose, but it's the Hawaiian name we're looking for. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Tom Crabtree from Aspen Medical. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Civil War steamships, whaling ships, and World War II aircraft all sitting on the ocean floor. This week, maritime archaeologist Hans von Tilburg sat down with us to share the stories of the sea. It's a sampling for what's in store in an event coming up on Thursday evening in Honolulu.
Unlike historic properties or archaeological sites on land, which everyone can see and are often kind of, you know, assessed and then become something else, get built on, things that are lost in the ocean oftentimes go right to the bottom and they're just sitting there. So when we find them and understand what we're looking at, they can open these windows onto stories that most folks have forgotten for a long time.
And there is a lot of activity that is underway. They're talking about some offshore wind farms, undersea cables, and a lot of that is going to disturb what's on the ocean floor.
It has the potential to. That's exactly right. So that's why, in fact, my agency got involved in assisting, you know, another agency in putting together the background snapshot, the understanding of what's out there now in terms of historic shipwrecks, aircraft that have been lost for years and years in Hawaii, just to understand from the cultural resource perspective, if there was, you know, a project in those areas, what types of things could be in that area, exactly.
And so the idea is then we need to protect what's there, but we need to identify what's there.
Sure, not everything's going to be historic properties per se or, you know, rate the level of protection that other things might, but some things are old and significant, and so it would be worthy in those cases to discuss, you know, what could be done if a project could have potential impacts. Absolutely.
And you've done a lot of research in this area. You also wrote a book about a Civil War ship that's out there.
Yeah. In fact, that's one of the stories that I'll be talking about on Thursday, the USS Saginaw, and just the fact that there was a Civil War ship out in the middle of the Pacific here, trying to open up the channel at Midway Atoll before there was anything else there, really, just kind of a deserted atoll island back in 1870. It's a great story of shipwreck and survival and rescue voyage. It's one of the epics of the Pacific, I think.
What was the maybe one thing that struck you as you were doing your research about that ship?
Well, that particular case, that was a small vessel, a side wheel vessel, in a Civil War era vessel, so not really built for long duty at sea, but there were 93 sailors on board. And this was from a day when the U.S. Navy was very multinational, actually. Not everyone wanted to go into the Navy, so there were 17 different languages being spoken on that small sidewheel vessel. And those guys were stranded at Kure Atoll near Midway for months. But the funny thing about that now, they probably didn't mention it back then, is they were all immediately on the enforced Atkins diet. They missed the bread. They missed the sugar terribly because there was nothing but, unfortunately, the monk seals and the albatross for them to survive. It was a difficult many months before they got off that island.
And is that in any particular area that, it's in the path of undersea cable or any of these other offshore developments that's being proposed at all?
Well, that's in an area in the Papahoenapua Marine National Monument, so that's, you know, fairly well protected. But the inventory that we worked on for Bureau of Ocean Energy Management addresses all of the wrecks around the main Hawaiian islands down here, and many of those are close to areas that could be proposed as offshore wind development, which is exactly why BOEM, Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, was looking for this type of inventory information.
So how do you actually conduct the surveys and do these studies when you go out and document what's there?
Well, it kind of depends on how deep the site is and the nature of the environment. You know, if it's diveable and we have the capacity, we'll want people with eyes on, you know, looking closely at artifacts and features. But a lot of ocean is pretty deep. And so then we're talking about, you know, a remote operated vehicle, an ROV dropped from a ship, to do video survey, or even the three-man research submersibles, the Hawaii Undersea Research Lab, and those folks have found a lot of wrecks in the deep ocean in the past. So those are a little more involved platforms for doing this type of research.
And are we still going to have Hurl to tap in the future? Because I know their funding was in question.
Funding is difficult, and I certainly hope they're able to stay and remain active in the islands, because despite the advances in, you know, ROV robot technology, which is remarkable, there are some things that manned submersibles can do, untethered submersibles can do, that tethered vehicles cannot.
And we had on our show Ira Flato, who's really into science, and he talks about, you know, you really have to follow the money. You know, what are the projects that are getting funded, and you know, what's the science that's being explored, and how does that look for maritime archaeology?
Well, you know, it's you know, you're talking to a liberal arts major, so following the money is sometimes an alien concept for me. But anyway, you know, we're part of a larger historic preservation field, and so that's always been just one component of marine resource conservation and preservation. And so hopefully what we've been able to achieve, and Office of National Marine Sanctuaries is one example where we have multiple archaeologists and preservationists across our system, hopefully we can maintain our level of capacity and continue to do the kind of historical and archaeological work in lakes and under the oceans.
Right. I mean, because we hear about the accounts of the explorers, and a lot of these vessels, you know, perished out in the open sea. And then it's like, okay, when we do find them, what's still intact? What is there on board these ships that could tell us more about the story?
Mm-hmm. That's very environmentally related, too. I mean, lots of warm marine tropical waters, you know, the wood will be decimated by the shipworm, Trito navalis, but the diagnostic artifacts, the tools, the engines, the tripods, the anchors, cannons, you know, other stuff does fairly well, while the wood might be, you know, have been vanished. But then later vessels, turn of the century, iron hulls, steel hulls, you have a different signature, a different footprint under the ocean. So it really changes from site to site and from era to era on what you can find underwater. But it does take some careful assessment then to take that into consideration.
What about the technology that's available? Because, you know, we hear a lot about, oh, gosh, you know, we've got virtual reality when you get cameras down, you know, under the ocean, that you can really document a lot and then bring some of those visuals back up for everybody to see and learn from.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question, because that is changing very quickly. Remote sensing technology to discover these types of properties underwater. Recording technology to assess the sites, diving technology for people to go deeper and deeper with closed circuit rebreathers, mixed gas closed circuit. So there is more access and more discovery going on, but which also means that, you know, we don't have to look at these deep water sites and bring everything up. That costs a lot to stabilize and conserve, and then where's the museum that's going to take it? We can do our work by just recording the site as it is, in situ, and share that with the public and learn a lot and not have to engage a whole another level of effort and funding.
I know in recent years when we've done stories about these research vessels that are out there, you know, they can actually in real time show us the images, whereas, you know, in the old days with Hurl, we used to wait until the scientists came back from their trip and then downloaded the video and then, you know, to be able to see what they saw. But now it's just instant. You can see it as they're doing it.
That's been really fun. That's been a change in the past few years. And, you know, it's changing the way that we do what we do and how we share it with the public. It's actually been fantastic. If we can do a live dive survey from discovery of something that goes from, you know, maybe it's a shipwreck, maybe it's just a big rock, and the ROV goes in and broadcasts that signal to the internet and folks are watching, they share in the discussion that we historians and archaeologists are conducting and share in the actual moments of discovery and analysis of that shipwreck site. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I just love seeing these fantastic creatures, you know, undersea creatures, and they just look like from another world. And to be able to kind of share that moment with the scientists, we're like, whoa, what was that?
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Well, when we do the live mission, certainly we'll have archaeologists, historians, and biologists along, because there will be those same creatures, especially if we're looking at a section of sea floor that's, you know, relatively flat and uneventful, and all of a sudden there's a shipwreck. That's habitat often. So there are pluses and minuses to these types of sites environmentally, and there will be some amazing creatures living in those wrecks.
So what's on tap for the future for your office? Do you have any big projects underway? You've just completed the survey now, but what's next?
Well, I'm looking forward to the talk on Thursday with Historic Hawaii Foundation, and that will be given at the Impact Hub in Hawaii. We're also looking at some possible other, you know, deep ocean projects, live dive projects, very possibly with Ocean Exploration Trust, and maybe using the vessel Nautilus that will be out here. Our ship, Okeanos Explorer, with our Office of Exploration and Research, has gone back to the Atlantic side. So, you know, it's finished its several years out here in the Pacific, but Nautilus is coming on board and has the capacity for live dive broadcast and discovery. And we hope to work an angle of history and archaeology into all the things that that vessel does.
That was NOAA's maritime archaeologist, Hans van Tilburg. He'll be the featured speaker at a Historic Hawaii Foundation event this Thursday. It runs from 5:30 p.m. to 7 at the Impact Hub at 1050 Queen Street. Registration for the free event is required. For links, check out our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
If there's such a thing as Polynesian fusion rock, Tavana is its biggest star, wrote the Honolulu Weekly. HPR invites this original talent to the Atherton Studio on Saturday, July 14th. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org for Tavana in the Atherton on the 14th. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
The primary election is just around the corner, and for months, candidates have been busy courting support from labor groups. On today's Reality Check with Honolulu Civil Beat, Nathan Eagle looks at the union endorsements in the governor's race. Morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
So what's the snapshot?
Well, the bottom line here is that union endorsements really do matter in Hawaii. We're, what, the second most unionized state? I think one out of every five workers in Hawaii is a member of a union. And so it's no surprise that Congresswoman Hanabusa and Governor Ige have been working really, really hard over the last several months to gain those endorsements and rack those up. The snapshot is Hanabusa's got way more. There's no doubt about that. She's a former labor attorney, so some of the political analysts I talked to weren't surprised by that. She's got really big ones like HGEA, like 43,000 members. But, there's always a but, Ige has the same one union that he had last time, the teachers union, and a couple others, a couple big ones too, even UPW. So it's a matter of, can he pull this off again with so little labor support compared to his primary challenger?
Right, but during the last election, didn't Governor Abercrombie have all the unions in his pocket?
He did, yep, almost all of them except the teachers union.
So that's the big key, huh?
And it could be. It could very well be.
And it's interesting because of the Janus decision at the Supreme Court, you know, just how might that affect the strength of unions going forward? And what's your sense as to how this might impact elections going forward?
Well, they're definitely worried about that decision and how it might affect them. I noticed in the SHOPO endorsement for Hanabusa, the police union, that was one of the first things they said as to why they supported her. They liked that she understood that impact and would really fight to basically keep Hawaii as unionized as possible.
Now, back in the day, a lot of those large unions meant a lot of bodies, a lot of hands, a lot of folks out there canvassing for the candidate. So, you know, what does that mean? Are we going to see Ige really pull this one out?
It's tough to tell. It really is tough to gauge. They do love the union support in large part because they can mobilize voters. You know, they are going to go knock on doors. They're also going to help contribute campaign cash so we can get those ads on TV and things like that that I think we've started seeing now. We're going to get a lot better sense of that, the money side of things, on Thursday, tomorrow. So we're going to be looking through that data when the campaign finance reports come out.
Right. And I know the unions are great for getting the people to get out on the street and hold campaign signs.
Absolutely.
But whether that really reflects the support and the turnout at the election is another question.
It is, and that's a tough one to gauge. I asked that of some of the different unions and different experts, and it sounded like my takeaway was some of the unions, they really do like follow that endorsement, and they do get out the vote. Others, I think University of Hawaii Professional Assembly was given as an example by Colin Moore, who's a political analyst there, that, yeah, that endorsement matters, but the professors that union represents are maybe more inclined, anecdotally at least, to go ahead and just vote for whatever candidate they think is the best, regardless of the endorsement.
And it's interesting with the teachers' union. I know that they obviously, you know, like the idea that we've got air conditioners in the classroom, which the governor was real big on, and then they also got the constitutional amendment passed this session.
Yeah, in a word, Corey Rosenlee, the head of the HSTA, the teachers' union, told me it was loyalty. That's why they decided to go ahead and stick with Ige this time around. He said that he's done good by them. If Hanabusa was running for a different election, he's like, we would probably have endorsed her for that other race. But for this one, they're going to stick with him because he has done a lot for them.
Okay, well, we'll see if David Ige turns out to be another one-term governor like we saw with Governor Abercrombie.
We're going to know soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Nathan. Every day
thanks.
We bring you a reality check from Honolulu Sybil Bee, today featuring reporter Nathan Eagle. For the full story, visit sybilbee.org.
Aloha. I'm Christine Altwies from Hawaii International Child. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
And after Monday's program, where we talked about the future of tourism in Hawaii, we heard from many of you on our talkback line. Casey on Hawaii Island had this to say.
You had a great conversation this morning, and I just have one thing that I'd like to offer. Out of state, non-residential owners should be taxed double what residential owners are taxed. Foreign-owned, non-residential ownership of real estate in any form, corporate or not, should be taxed double that. And that would solve your problem, because then people wouldn't come here and buy the property up and put B&Bs in. You'd have more residential farmers and that sort of thing.
Hi, my name's Mike from Kihei, Maui. I operate a commercial sailing vessel for tourists. We have a completely packed island here, and to erroneously say that we're looking for more tourists to come to Maui is not correct. Everyone is talking about management rather than attraction. Thank you.
It's Randall, and I'm calling from Kailua Kona on the Big Island. I'm an Airbnb owner, and we've found that we can direct our guests to many other things on this island that are volcano-related. The whole island could be Volcanoes National Park, but people fixate on one location. And one of the great advantages of having local hosts and people staying in our home is that we can point them to a lava tube that's not in the national park. We can point them to things that could give them that experience. And I think that perhaps that's something that could be done with the crowd problem in Kauai and in Kailua on Oahu as well, is to begin to focus our industry away from key point tourist destinations and help diversify and spread our tourism crowds around the island. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
Hi, my name is Robert Friedlander. I'm calling from Maui. Calling about tourism and zip lines. The zip lines are a problem on Maui. There's just no rules regulating where and when and how they can be, and therefore there are some that are really disrupting neighborhoods, and they may be good for tourism, they may not be, but the reality of it is they're they should be highly regulated, and they're hardly regulated at all at this point. Thank you very much. Aloha.
And thanks for the feedback from everybody. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217.
Any number of efforts have been made down through the years to bring younger voters to the polls. Nothing to date has been able to bring their rate of participation beyond a dismal 40%. In today's edition of The Long View, contributing editor Neil Milner looks at reasons why and at efforts to change that pattern. Good morning, Neil.
Morning, Chris.
It holds at 40% even no matter what election cycle you talk about.
Well,
right?
It's gone up a little. It goes down a little. The 2016, 40% of the 18 to 21s voted. 50% had registered. So, and that was about right. For Hillary Clinton, it was too low because the lack of youth support for her, the lack of turnout, really did hurt her. But we can safely say that 18 to 21 is a low voter turnout group. There's been a lot of efforts to change that. Nothing has really been very successful. Things will work for a short time, and some things have even been counterproductive.
Isn't this the time of life when, you know, having just turned 18, now you're able to participate in society, you're full of beans, you're going to change the world? What happened to that?
Well, I think in some ways that's mythical. It's never been more than a group, a small group. But this is the more realistic way to look at the fact. If you're 18 to 21, you know, it's basically adults moralizing against kids when they talk about higher voter turnouts. If you're 18 to 21,
much as we're doing now.
Well, I'm trying not to, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
People vote, at least they begin to vote as they begin to become more attached to the political system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not just an emotional attachment. It's when you begin to pay taxes, when your life is more directly anchored into the political system.
Mm-hmm.
And so that if you're younger, you haven't had that experience yet. Also, voting is a habit, and it takes some time to develop. And from some of the research, and we'll talk a little bit about that today, like a lot of other good and bad habits that you learn from your parents, if your parents are less likely to vote, you're less likely to vote.
Mm-hmm.
If your parents are more, and so on. So essentially, once we cut through the kinds of mythologizing and the kind of moralizing, we begin to understand a little bit more about why they don't vote. Now, that doesn't mean it's good, but it means that a lot of the interventions that we've tried to do, all the way from rock concerts to making it easier to register, sometimes have some important effects. And remember, any small effect is better than no effect, but it's not anything that we've been able to grab onto in a large and definitive way. What we see now is so much literature, so much press about the salience of gun violence and Parkland High School students and doing all of those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's going to make a difference or not in voter turnout, we'll see.
Right after Parkland, there was an enormous amount of momentum behind that movement. Haven't heard that much in the last few weeks.
Well,
right?
I mean, a lot of that momentum was, frankly, coming from adults who should know better about kids. The Parkland students that got involved are remarkably smart and remarkably efficacious, and they undoubtedly come from families that are more politically involved,
mm-hmm.
more likely to vote because they tend to be middle class and upper middle class. But to put the burden on that and to naively assume that mobilizing around that is going to be effective kind of denies us. Now, again, I want to be careful here. They're doing stuff that a lot of youth groups haven't done. They've been fairly persistent. But you're right. The fact that they've disappeared from the press suggests that most of this stuff is nuts and bolts work, and when the press gets tired romanticizing the efficaciousness of these
mm-hmm.
kids, that's when the real hard work starts.
The news audience gets impatient with stories pretty quickly. I mean, a news consumer has a tendency to say, you know, regardless of what the story actually is, I'm sick of hearing about Syria, or I'm sick of hearing about the volcano. even though it might be the most important thing, you know, leading the news.
Well, it could be, but I think there's also something else going on there that, let's put aside the outrageous criticism that a lot of the right gave to these Parkland students that was just really awful.
They're actors.
Right. And, yeah. The other side of it is the well-meaning notions that we had about the courage and the interest and the of surviving this thing. I wrote a column actually about the fact that we minimized the kind of psychological trauma that these students were going to go through, and you can't just assume that working in politics is going to get away from that. But look at the difference between a movement like that and a kind of national movement that raises salience, especially among adults. But what you're really trying to do is get people who have never voted before to vote. Now, from a kind of adult logic, we say, well, look, they're the ones on the front line. Schools aren't the same anymore because of violence. And they may be right. But what you have to remember is how hard it is to change habits. And we want to see the two studies that I looked at today show ways that you can affect voter turnout of youth. But they're kind of exceptional in the ways that in what they did and the kind of impact that they did.
Well, one of these that you sent me, I'm just going to read you the title. How do we get more young people to vote as adults? Cash transfers to their parents.
Well, yeah, that's a bet. You know, the bad thing about that, that's another one of those economics terms that means something to economists that has a totally different connotation. Here's what happened, okay? This is a study that's based on what's called the Great Smoky Mountain Study.
Uh-huh.
In 1993, a bunch of social scientists began to study families in Western Carolina, a fairly poor area.
Right.
And halfway through this study, after about 4 years or so, a casino opens in the area, in Cherokee land. Right after that, the Cherokees who live in this community begin to get cash transfer payments. In other words, it's their reservation, it's their casino. Mm-hmm. The other people don't. So these clever social scientists later on say, well, let's look at the differences between the kids who were in families that got sudden increases in income and the ones who didn't. And what they found is that over the long term, there was a significant increase in voting turnout on the basis of folks who got the people who had been children during the time when there was an increase in income, as compared to this other group. Now, so they said, look, you got a natural experiment here. Everything is the same except the money thing, which is about right. The point that they make is good news and bad news. The point that they make is, look, we always look at tinkering around with various things about making it easy to register or about harping on kids to vote or all this kind of stuff. Money matters. That what happens, what may happen, is that you get more money into a household. They become more attached to the community. There's a lot of other things we need to know, but this follows what we do know about the relationship between inequality and voting. The poorer you are, you're less likely to vote. But that's a long-term solution, and it's not something that's going to be very feasible in the eyes of the American public, but it's an important finding.
It requires that you take off your blinders about the existence of a class system.
Yes, it does. We should take off our inequality binders in all kinds of ways.
Well, because what you just described is two members of the same social class, some of whom suddenly get bumped up.
That's right.
With more money. Otherwise, everything is the same. So you've now created a bourgeoisie.
Well, yeah, bourgeoisie may be a little strong. But the other part of that is that how consistent that is with findings about poverty and social institutions. As you begin to become more attached, as you begin to have more money, you become more attached to the social institutions around you. And that's part of the inequality argument.
Which will continue.
Yes, it will. But it's interesting that it comes out this way, and yes, in voter turnout.
Well, that's what we need to keep busy with issues like this, right? Thanks a lot, Neil.
Sure.
Political analyst Neil Milner taught political science at UH-Monroe for 40 years and is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View.
I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Randall Zala.
Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll learn about the state-of-the-art in biomedical engineering and hear about the Student Medical Device Accelerator Program.
The 40th International Conference of the IEEE Engineering in Medicine and Biology Society is here, and we'll get an inside look.
That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we look back in time at flightless birds that roam the Hawaiian Islands. They foraged on the forest floor and even stole eggs from smaller ground nesting species. They didn't last long after human settlement. They were large and flightless, making them easy targets. But for 3 million years before humans showed up, they lived in an enviable, predator-free paradise. Their most distinctive feature was a jaw that resembled a turtle's. One description reads, the main distinguishing feature was a remarkable beak, which had a rostrum almost as high as it was long, with a broad palatal surface, and with nostrils oriented almost vertically rather than horizontally. The structure of this feeding apparatus appears convergent on that of a tortoise and indicates adaptation to a diet of plants. They were wiped out even before Captain Cook arrived, and today we asked you for their Hawaiian name. It means lost fowl. And Moanalo is the answer we were looking for.
And Catherine, we had several calls on this, but Mark Ader from Curtistown was the first with the mostest. It was a really popular quiz. We got lots of calls, and people remember studying about the Moanalo in school. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. Committed to accelerating literacy and learning for students throughout the state, welcoming students, parents, teachers, and administrators back to school. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
It was a parade unlike ever seen in Hawaii. Marionettes and puppet theater, they're iconic in the art scene in France. And for the past year, little hands have been busy creating masterpieces out of paper mache. Imagine 8-foot-high puppets of King Kalakaua and Pele, as well as Hawaiian warriors and amakua, like the shark and honey creeper. They all came to life as part of an after-school project called Karanda Fray. Give a listen as we explore the pageantry of puppets.
It is quite the spectacle. We are in the 13th arrondissement, Rue de la Fontaine à Moulade, and the neighborhood children have gathered at this corner, waiting for the parade to begin.
The magic of marionettes draws throngs of families with little children here in the Kellerman district of Paris. It's like fairy dust as characters larger than life pop out into the streets, commanding your attention. Thanks to the efforts of the Hawaii-France Alliance, the Hawaiian Islands are showcased in not just one, but two parades. The making of 39 giant papier-mâché puppets are a year's worth of effort by inner-city children. Director Madeleine Bois says it's developed into a family affair.
À partir de 8 ans, ils peuvent venir, mais avec un papa ou une maman ou une grand-mère.
In the past, the exotic cultures of Egypt and Asia have enthralled the organizers of this puppet theater group. This year, because of personal ties between Kilohana Silve, Kumu of Halau Hula o Manoa, the Hawaiian kingdom and culture of our Pacific Island is shining brightly on this festival stage.
Well, I came here several months ago during the winter and spent an evening with the children, told them Hawaiian legends, and the dancers from Halau Hula o Manoa shared hula that also told stories that were also connected to our legends, like Pele dances, when I told a legend about Pele. And they really spent the entire year learning about Hawaiian history and culture. They learned a chant. They learned a navigation chant. And they became interested in specific characters. And you can see how many creations there are here. There are hula dancers, there are amakua, there are kings and queens, very specific people that they studied, like King Kamehameha. It's amazing to see one of the little boys chose Kamapua'a, for instance. Mm-hmm. So they really knew their subject, and they put such heart and soul into the creation of each of these characters.
Kilohana Silb tells us the theater program began under the direction of Beauvoir and Valerie Martin Mercier, two friends whose love of experimentation with puppetry has blossomed over two decades.
En fait, avec mon ami, on se connaît depuis le lycée.
She and her friend met in lycée, which is the equivalent of high school here in France, and they both had a passion for art, and they became interested in working with puppets. Thought that was a very interesting expression, and had the opportunity to develop their association here in this neighborhood.
Members of the Paris Halau, most who are native French speakers, chant in Hawaiian and march along the parade route with their kala'au. The hula implements aren't something you see or hear in use very often in gay Paris. Parade onlookers include Elsa Demexa, a Halau member who hails from Ethiopia and now splits her time between Alaska and the Big Island.
That parade, it was all the puppets, the giant, humongous puppets were all done by children in this area that are disadvantaged. And what they created, what they learned about the Hawaiian culture was amazing. It was just beautiful. They had a Kinkamehameha, a puppet that was beautiful. It was just spectacular, and it was so well received.
It's a heartwarming sight to see little French children soak up the impromptu hula lessons, eager to learn more and feel the magic of Hawaii, if but for an afternoon. They are touched by aloha. And later this week, we will take you outside of Paris as the Hawaii Festival heads to the countryside and shoreline of Normandy. For a visual treat with images and video of the Hawaii Festival, we continue to feature stories from France. Check our webpage, hawaiipublicradio.org.
A lot of different activities going on throughout the state. Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in the community that might be a little under the radar. Well, we've got a play coming tomorrow, Derek.
Yes, the Pulitzer Prize winning play, Crimes of the Heart, is a story of three sisters who reunite back home in Mississippi after one of them shoots her abusive husband. Eventually, the sisters must all come to terms with the consequences of their actions. Crimes of the Heart premieres in Wits End Theater, that's in the Kukui Grove Center, tomorrow night in Lihue, and it runs on weekends through July 29th.
Well, they'll have plenty to talk about, won't they?
Oh, yes.
And you can enjoy a dinner and free movie tomorrow in Waimea Valley.
The Haleiwa Farmers Market is every Thursday from 2 to 6 p.m. in the Pikake Pavilion, and it features fresh produce, local arts and crafts, live music, and ono ready-to-eat food. And afterwards, you can see a free family movie on the main lawn. Tomorrow's film is Pete's Dragon. That's an updated version. I remember the first one with Helen Reddy. I don't remember that one. Back in the 70s, yes.
No kidding.
And anyway, this Pete's Dragon starts at 7:15.
I'm tomorrow. Too young, I guess. To
yeah, remember. Yeah. I vaguely remember it.
And you can see the stars of tomorrow on Hawaii Island.
That's the title of a concert presented by the Hawaii Performing Arts Festival. You'll see HPAF's young singers in a concert of songs and arias. It's in HPA's Davies Chapel in Waimea at 7 p.m. tomorrow, and it's free.
Good to hear about those free events always. Thanks,
yes.
Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
In Phoenix, a plain white van pulls up to an empty office building.
They opened the van and out came the kids, and then they just kind of shuffled them in there very quickly.
And they were kept inside.
They have those windows blocked off. They're not even seeing sunlight.
Where immigrant children are held on the next reveal.
This evening at 7.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Coming up tomorrow, we'll look at the changing face of journalism. It's a panel, and we'll be taking your calls.
Do tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And you can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. This program and all our past ones are available on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. We will be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.